You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's show, Obama does all he can not to get involved again, but this time it's a domestic crisis he'd rather not be drawn on.
Let me call once again for us to seek some understanding rather than simply holler at each other. Let's seek to heal rather than to wound each other.
The historian James Boyes and our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield will examine why Mr. President would prefer to talk about Iraq than the riots in Missouri. And we'll look in depth at a few of today's other key stories, including what does the deal between Norway and Russia mean for the future of our energy supplies, and how does the West continue to get tough on Moscow. Plus, our man in Nairobi brings us the latest from where he is, and our captain of culture, Robert Bound, tells us what musical treasures he's found at this year's Green Man Fest. Festival in Wales. Compared to some I've been around, but I really tried so hard. That echo course like the music. Hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on. That's all coming up on today's episode of Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, right now. But before we get launched on all that, let's hear the latest world news now from James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The United Nations Refugee Agency says it's launching a major aid operation to get supplies to more than 500,000 people displaced by fighting in northern Iraq. Hundreds of thousands have fled their homes since fighters led by the militant Islamic State group swept through much of the north and west of Iraq in June, threatening to begin to break up the country. A four-day airlift of tents and other goods will start on Wednesday to Arbil from Jordan, followed by road convoys from Turkey and Jordan and sea shipments from Dubai. The UNHCR spokesman is Adrian Edwards.
The major focus of this push is on improving living conditions for the displaced in the region, particularly people without shelter or housing. Conditions remain desperate for those without access to suitable shelter, for people struggling to find food and water to feed their families, and for those without access to primary medical care. Many are still coming to grips with the tragedy they've been through in recent weeks, fleeing homes with nothing, and many are trying to cope with the loss of loved ones.
Israel says militants have fired rockets from Gaza in violation of a truce and that it had struck back with attacks in the Palestinian enclave. The new fighting puts talks in Cairo on a long-term ceasefire in jeopardy. An Israeli official said Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ordered his negotiating team in Egypt to return home, but there was no word from Israel whether the move spelt the collapse of indirect talks with the Palestinians on ending the Gaza war and charting the territory's future. Ebola cases in West Africa have risen to 2,240, including 1,229 deaths, according to the World Health Organization, who reported the toll in four countries. Fadela Chaib spoke to reporters in Geneva today.
Food has been delivered also to hospitals where patients are taken care of and people under quarantine who are not able to leave their homes to purchase food. Providing regular food supplies is a very important means of limiting unnecessary movement.
And the World Food Programme is stepping up emergency food deliveries to the quarantined areas. Police in Missouri have arrested 31 people in continuing protests over the fatal police shooting of an unarmed teenager. Two people were injured and police came under heavy gunfire in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, which has seen a series of violent protests since the death of 18-year-old Michael Brown on August the 9th. The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration has barred all American airlines from flying over Syria, saying the ongoing armed conflict and volatile security environment poses a serious potential threat to civil aircraft. 15 bodies have been retrieved from the scene of an attack on a convoy of refugees in eastern Ukraine. Earlier, a rebel source told correspondents no one had survived an attack on a convoy of refugees in the Luhansk area on Monday. Ukraine has accused pro-Russian rebels of attacking the convoy, but they have denied involvement. Authorities have declared a state of emergency in western Panama after Chiriqui Viejo River burst its banks, damaging dozens of homes and killing at least 9 residents. Heavy rainfalls in Chiriqui, some 500 kilometers west of the capital, turned the community's nearby river into floodwaters, washing away homes and residents in its wake. Panamanian President Juan Carlos Varela told devastated areas to pledge support for hard-hit families. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much. James will return in a little under half an hour to bring us a full roundup of today's news. In the meantime, though, you're with Midori House. We take a look at the day's headlines after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To va Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
The time is 18:06 if you're listening in London, 13:06 lunchtime in New York. Joining me now in the studio with their take on today's news is James Boyes, political historian and author of the book Clinton's Grand Strategy and a forthcoming book about American foreign policy under Bill Clinton, and our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield, who is joining us behind the microphone to unpick what is happening in the world. Let us begin with President Obama and his extraordinary comments that he'd rather talk about Iraq rather than the continued violence in Missouri. Let's have a listen to what he said at yesterday's press conference.
To a community in Ferguson that is rightly hurting and looking for answers, let me call once again for us to seek some understanding rather than simply holler at each other. Let's seek to heal rather than to wound each other. As Americans, we've got to use this moment to seek out our shared humanity that's been laid bare by this moment. The potential of a young man and the sorrows of parents, the frustrations of a community, the ideals that we hold as one united American family.
James Boyes, just listening to that, I thought two things. Firstly, Trayvon Martin. And secondly, this sounded like Obama as a local politician.
It's remarkable, isn't it? It was quite an interesting press conference. First of all, his attire. I don't know if you actually saw it, but he was standing at the podium in the Brady press briefing room in a very formal setting. No tie. You might say, well, what's that? Well, the American presidents generally, you know, put a suit and tie on to address the American people. Quite interesting, considering he just jetted back in from Martha's Vineyard for this event. So the attire was interesting. His demeanor was interesting. You're absolutely spot on, the idea of being a local politician. This did not sound like a commander-in-chief. I keep wanting to come back to JFK in 1961 when he's trying to corral the world against Soviet communism whilst he's also got the civil rights movement brewing at home. In other words, how do you unite a nation, in this case against ISIS, for example, when you've got a fractured American society? Obama, I don't think, knows whether he wants to be a black American president, a president for all Americans, or a president for the black community. And at the moment, I don't think he's necessarily succeeding in any of those.
Steve Bloomfield, we'll get on to the issue of Iraq in a moment. Just listening to what James said, what kind of president did you see during that press conference?
Well, I think, as James points out, you know, Barack Obama has to tread a very fine line that no other president has had to tread before. This is the first black president in American history. And there is an expectation from some people that he should therefore... that he should act like a black president rather than just the US president. And he's got to try and work out how to balance that. And as we saw with the case of Trayvon Martin, where he was far more emotional, he said, you know, if I had a son, yeah, he would look like Trayvon. And in this case, he's decided to be a bit more cool and detached. And let's not forget, despite the fact that, you know, we go on about Barack Obama's rhetoric and how good he is at the set piece speech, he is also cool and detached and, some would say, quite aloof. And I think this whole situation in Ferguson, Missouri has really taken the American political establishment by surprise. they're all on holiday. Yeah, and as James says, Obama has just been in Martha's Vineyard. He's got back. He's getting his head around what's going on. He's slightly in holiday mode. And you find that, you know, in all sorts of cases, we'll get on to Iraq, and it's something that David Cameron's had to deal with as well in this country, of being in a slight holiday mood but trying to, you know, get back into serious issues. And it's difficult to get that balance right.
Who do you think he's talking to in that speech? I mean, if you were in Ferguson and you had ignored a curfew and you had heard stories of, you know, people having gas canisters fired at them by the police, to what degree would an off-duty Obama on a podium trying to be the local governor actually make you think, okay, I'm not going out tonight, I'll wait to see justice to be seen to be done, as he is so enthusiastically pushing?
Sure, I don't think it would make any difference at all. I every time something like this happens, one is always drawn back to the classic Tom Wolfe novel, The Bonfire of the Vanities. And when you see someone like Al Sharpton, who after all was a major influence behind one of the characters in that novel, in there whipping up the situation, it's fascinating. Don't forget, let's not critique America for this. You know, we've had similar situations in this country in 2011, for example, when Mark Duggan was shot by the police in London. The idea that you have a spark of an incident that gets whipped up by a whole variety of people who are there to perpetuate their own agendas. We're seeing that playing out in the United States at this point, I think. The question is, how much impact will this have? People are talking about it impacting the midterms. I disagree with that. I think this is going to be very, very localized. I think, you know, it's clearly a blemish upon the American body politic, but I don't think it's going to play out hugely in terms of overall election results come November.
What will be interesting will be how left-wing Democrats, if such a thing still exists, respond to this, because, you know, there is, you know, relatively clear good guys and bad guys here. You know, this is a situation where you've got a vast majority of the population is black, and yet 95% of the police force is white. The way the police force has been reacting to this has been absolutely appalling, from obviously the initial incident through to, you know, over the weekend releasing CCTV footage of Mike Brown allegedly stealing something, as if that showed that therefore he's a bad guy and deserved to be shot. Everything they've done has been awful. And yet Barack Obama, not just with Trayvon Martin, but if you go back to one of the earliest cases in his presidency, Henry Louis Gates, the professor, the black professor who was arrested trying to break into his own house, and Barack Obama said that the police had acted stupidly. And again, he got caught up with that. The press jumped on him because you shouldn't, if you're the president, accuse the police of being stupid. So he's always had this very fine line to tread, and sometimes he gets it right, in the case of Trayvon Martin, I argue, and sometimes in this case he gets it wrong.
But if you have such a clear-cut case of good guys and bad guys and the militarisation of the police that has been discussed in at such length since this incident last week, is it not the Commander-in-Chief's role to openly question some things which need to be addressed, whether within the situation that they're faced with immediately? There are bigger questions that need to
yes.
be asked here,
shouldn't No, there absolutely are. And I think, you know, there should be. And I think he's made a mistake here. We'll see what happens, you know, now that Eric Holder, the Attorney General, has been sent down there to oversee the investigation, what will come of that. And I think, you know, I would not be surprised if we see a smarter, better, more thought out speech from Barack Obama in the coming days or weeks once this has died down.
Steve rightly talked about Barack Obama's great rhetoric there, and there's no doubt about it. He can deliver a set speech from auto cue like no other president, a very interesting style. Where he has got into trouble in the past is on these ad hoc moments at the podium, the whole red line remark, for example, with Syria, when he goes off track. If you look at his press conference yesterday, it was a very short initial opening statement. He took a very few number of questions, and the last one from a retiring journalist was where he got drawn into this long, interesting, emotional response to this situation. I don't think he wants to focus upon this. He does not want to be the black president at all. I think he's someone who was quite happy talking about race before he was president, and I believe fundamentally that he will be a very interesting role model for black males after he leaves the presidency. But as president, I think he's proven once and for all that the idea of being post-racial doesn't exist.
So you mentioned that he doesn't want to be the black president. Does he want to be, let's moving on to our next topic, the president who had to invade Iraq again?
Absolutely not. I mean, this must be Barack Obama's worst nightmare yesterday. He's getting drawn into racial issues he doesn't want to get near. He does not want to be seen to be deploying troops to what Americans would call Iraq. This idea that now all of a sudden he's getting sucked back into this environment that he, of course, Steve, you guys know well, campaigned vociferously against getting involved. He was going to be the person who drew America out of Iraq. Now, all of a sudden, that is a very different ball game, and his legacy will be very different as a result of this, I think.
Do you think a few weeks ago we would have been discussing the fact that Obama would rather talk about Iraq than a domestic issue?
Well, indeed. Barack Obama is the fourth consecutive American president to bomb Iraq, but arguably he's the first one who's been absolutely justified in doing it. Yeah, I think it's very hard to look at the situation in northern Iraq, the threat to those 40,000 Yazidis on Mount Sinjar, and say, no, we should do nothing. We've been involved in Iraq before. We don't want to go down that road again. We're washing our hands of it. I think there was absolutely no way that Barack Obama, the US, the West generally could step back from there. Now that you've taken that first step, there comes the issue of what happens next. Now, if we've agreed that ISIS, the Islamic State, ISIL, whatever they want to call themselves, are a threat to ordinary people, and that there are people in danger, and that we have the wherewithal to help them, then I wonder whether, morally, ethically, we really can stand aside and say we don't want to get drawn back into Iraq.
There is that second justification, though, that people have all mentioned, which is it was the US who kind of created the mess in the first place and sort of splintered Iraq. And in, you know, there was no Al-Qaeda before the Americans
came in. It was, but
that
doesn't mean we can say, well, we created this mess, but we're going to do nothing to clean it up now. I mean, I think that just makes it all the more important that actually the US accepts that, you know, there was the horrible phrase from Colin Powell that he used from the Pottery Barn, the store in the US, their rule that say, if you break it, you own it. That which was a warning about Iraq, but it was right. You know, the US has helped to break Iraq. It now has a duty to make sure it does its best to fix it, whether that is in the past pulling troops out, or whether that is in this case actually taking action against ISIS. You know, that point stands.
James, Steve briefly touched on the idea of mission creep there, sure. Something that Reuters actually questioned Obama on yesterday. And he said, typically what happens with mission creep is we start deciding that we're the ones who have to do it all ourselves. He desperately tries not to get sucked in. But if we think about it, just 2-3 weeks ago, there were very targeted missions, airstrikes, against a tiny group of ISIS fighters to protect the Yazidis. Suddenly now we're rescuing Mosul's dam back.
Yep.
This is mission creep without him even wanting it to be, isn't it?
You can see it right in front of your eyes, can't you? You know, we start off talking about humanitarian intervention. Now it's targeted, limited strikes. Now it's a much broader idea. You know, Barack Obama's got the same problem that the British Prime Minister David Cameron has, which is that the British people and the American people have heard this all before. We're only going to do this. It's targeted, limited, etc., etc. It's no surprise that there's calls to recall Parliament in this country because, of course, again, you know, you start talking about one kind of operation, it immediately bleeds into something else. And if you're going to start having an operation that has military involvement, then, you know, there is a role for Parliament and Congress to play with this without wanting to undermine the office of the presidency or the prime minister in any way, shape or form.
Are we going to see some political capital being made out of this, namely that Obama has had an awful lot of criticism levied at him for not taking action? He was criticised for Syria. He's been criticised for not taking a strong enough stance against Israel. Is this the time when Obama suddenly looks a bit like the hero of the day again?
I hope that it doesn't get framed like that. I think, you know, all Western leaders at the moment have this issue of, and in fact, you know, they've had it for a while, particularly after Iraq, the second time around, the 2003 invasion, over how to intervene. And it's almost as if we've decided that they're either we are in or we are out. Either we are taking action or we are standing on the sidelines. And there is, to coin a phrase, a third way. And, you know, we don't necessarily have to commit ground troops. We could call for a UN Security Council resolution, which with Iraq's backing, Iraq could ask for UN peacekeepers with a Chapter 7 mandate, so able to take action to protect civilians, which, you know, the US and the UK could then be involved in. At least that makes it international. And it's interesting, actually, on this. Iraq now is one of the few things, major issues, the UN Security Council can agree on. Both China and Russia were quite happy to back resolutions which condemned what ISIS were doing in Iraq. So there's the leeway there to do something that's international.
Very briefly, couldn't agree with Steve more. In theory, in practice, that becomes slightly difficult in terms of putting US troops under a UN flag after what happened in Somalia. The idea of command and control issues under a UN mandate is not as easy as one would hope and it would like it to be. Again, American presidents have talked about a standing UN army before and after they've left office. Once they're in office, they are loath to surrender their role as commander-in-chief.
It would introduce a whole new world of who the world's policeman would be there if that happened.
Absolutely.
That could be something that could be applied in all manner of other places were it to work. In the meantime, though, we have to leave this subject and we'll move on to a couple of others in a moment, including a new Russian oil deal with Norway, of all places, and Tony Abbott, international statesman. James Boyce and Steve Bloomfield will stay with me for the second half of today's examination of the news headlines on Midori House.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
It's 1822 here in London. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Joining me in the studio is Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, and James Boyes. Now, it feels just moments ago that Europe stood united in its condemnation of Russia's behaviour towards the conflict in Ukraine. Nations stood shoulder to shoulder. Measures were designed to kick Vladimir Putin where it hurts. And so what if the resulting sanctions imposed on Europe meant that Polish apple farmers would have to puree their excess crops that should have ended up in the aisles of a Moscow supermarket? Well, Steve Bloomfield, why in this light has Norway decided to climb into bed with Russia over oil?
Well, firstly, Norway is not part of the European Union. So in the same way that the Swiss are considering selling their cheese to Russia now that Russia can't get its Dutch Edam, and bizarrely Finnish cheese, which I discovered today, is apparently a big seller in Russia. And now there's all this cheese which was going over the board, which is now going to be sold back into Finland itself.
There is that spirit, though, that Norway is kind of European in many ways.
It is. But I mean, I think what's interesting here is this is a deal between Statoil, the Norwegian state oil company, and Rosneft, which is partly owned not just by the Russians, but also by BP, British Oil Company, or once British oil company. When it comes to these sorts of oil deals, it's a bit more complicated. Don't forget as well that Germany has big gas deals with Russia. I think this idea that somehow we're going to just shut everything off with Russia is, you know, as much as some of us might think that's a good idea, just simply isn't going to happen. These sanctions have been pretty well targeted so far. What they don't do, because it would be catastrophic for pretty much everyone, is what they don't do is completely shut off all economic ties between Russia and the European Union and the US. There is just too much business going on between them. Now, what they are able to do is limit a certain amount of business and punish Russia in some way. I imagine that Norway's prime minister is likely to be fielding the odd slightly perturbed call from other European leaders if they can get off their holidays.
There will be some robust questions to Oslo. James, just listening to what Steve said, he mentioned the idea of the sanctions targeting Russia where it hurt. Rosneft was on the list of targeted firms. It has had to go to Moscow to ask for money. Rosneft was in a mess. This helps it slightly, does it?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. I think what's been demonstrated time and time again over the decades is that sanctions regimes are very easy to get around. I mean, you were kind enough in your introduction to mention my book, Clinton's Grand Strategy. Back in the mid-1990s, the Clinton administration tried to adopt a new approach to Iran and Iraq to squeeze them through a policy called dual containment. And this would involve, basically, as Steve described the policy towards Russia, but basically putting a noose around them and saying, right, no ties, no deals with Iran and Iraq. The problem is if you've got France, for example, or Russia dealing exclusively with oil and having bilateral deals with these countries, it's not in their national interest to shut down those relationships. So that failed. We're seeing the same thing here now. You're hearing this bizarre idea. America cannot put a man in space anymore. It relies upon Russia to send its troops to the International Space Station. So Russia can get around an awful lot of these things by saying, right, you want to get your astronauts into space, you want to get them home again, let's deal.
Which is a sorry state of affairs.
Perhaps, yes, but I think also what's interesting is that the European Union certainly works far more effectively now in terms of imposing their own sanctions than perhaps they did in the 90s. There's a bit more uniformity amongst the 28 members. And they seem to be sort of dealing with the US as well in a decent way. So I think that there's certainly scope to do, increase sanctions on a country to force them into a position. As we've seen, in fact, with Iran over the last two or three years, the Iranian economy has gone into freefall, partly because Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was pretty bad when it came to economics, but also because there were really tight sanctions, which had a dangerous effect on the Iranian economy. Now, Europe and the US will be hoping that despite Norway's little bit of help with Russia over drilling for oil in the Barents Sea, that this range of sanctions will also have an impact on the Russian economy.
Gentlemen, we move on to our final topic of this half hour. Russia remains firmly within our sights, though. We turn, though, to a man whose entry onto the world stage has not been without its recent wobbles. But recently, Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott started to look a bit more statesmanlike. He waded in immediately after the death of 38 of his country's citizens in the crash of MH17. It was all very admirable. It got the UN Security Council to do something quickly, but people are now wondering whether this is beginning to backfire. In fact, James, I'm just looking at one commentator who just went, his condemnation of Russia has not so much tied Vladimir Putin's hands as backed him into a corner and forced him to swing. This is Putin and Russia acting as one really would expect, and Tony Abbott looking a little bit sheepish.
Yeah, you're not wrong. When I was reading this story, I kept thinking, actually, funny enough, about Alex Salmond and Scotland as a parallel with this.
Do we have to?
I'm sorry, I hate to raise the spectre, but you might recall a couple of years ago when Salmond decided he was going to emerge as an international statesman and release the alleged Lockerbie terrorist on humanitarian grounds, and he got into this all highfalutin idea about, oh, it's Scottish values and this, that and the other. And we're very quickly made to look very, very foolish by introducing concepts of sort of like, you know, ideology, and we're going to have a heartfelt foreign policy effectively. I think what you're seeing in Australia is quite similar. A naivete with regard to foreign affairs, a lack of experience coming through at an international level. And again, you know, what's the lesson of the Cuban Missile Crisis? You don't put your enemy into a corner where they've got to come out swinging. You give people a way out. Australia's not been involved enough on the world stage diplomatically to perhaps learn this, and they have, I think, made a critical error with regard to that.
Steve, is this a question of Tony Abbott being a little bit naive in terms of the fact that he's new to the role, or is this actually a problem with Abbott himself?
I think actually, you know, this is slightly unfair on Tony Abbott. I think the way he's dealt with MH17 has actually been pretty good. He's had some good turns of phrase. He's talked well. I don't think him slagging off Vladimir Putin, you know, makes too much difference, you know, either here nor there. I don't think Russia cares particularly about Australia. Where I would be concerned about Australia's foreign policy, you know, in the 12 months of Tony Abbott, or the 11 months of Tony Abbott, is in terms of its friendship with Sri Lanka. And its relationship with Indonesia, which has completely fallen apart, the Indonesian relationship, from the absolute get-go. And with Sri Lanka, the danger is because he has this obsession with, as they call it, stopping the boats, preventing people, you know, would-be asylum seekers actually reaching Australia. That has led him to do deals with, in the case of Sri Lanka, a nasty dictatorship. And it's one that Australia shouldn't be friends with. And yet, because of this very narrow domestic policy issue, they are very much in bed with a regime that they really shouldn't have anything to do with.
Final and very, very brief word to James. Looking at what Steve has just said, the issues with the Indonesian boat people, the spying scandal within Indonesia, the issues with Sri Lanka, the issues with Russia. Russia, as Steve has just said, isn't that worried about Australia. Who is? Who's going to listen?
I have no idea. New Zealand, maybe, but that's probably about it. You know, I mean, the Americans are trying to put putting a new base in there, so they clearly got aspirations in the Pacific. You remember the Pacific pivot? Well, that long time ago.
I thought we still were.
Who knows? It's a second term. Anything's possible.
Steve Bloomfield and James Boyes, many thanks for joining us here on Midori House.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
This is Mônaco 24.
Plenty still to come then in the second half of today's Midori House. We check in with our correspondent in Nairobi. We talk Chinese blockbuster TV and we review this year's Green Man Festival in Wales with our culture editor Robert Bound. But first, with the time at 31 minutes past the hour, let's get the latest now from James.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says it's launching a major aid operation to get supplies to more than 500,000 people displaced by fighting in northern Iraq. Hundreds of thousands have fled their homes since fighters led by the militant Islamic State group swept through much of the north and west of Iraq, threatening to break up the country. Ebola cases in West Africa have risen to 2,240, including 1,229 deaths, according to the World Health Organization, who reported the toll in four countries. The World Food Programme is stepping up emergency food deliveries to the quarantined areas. Police in Missouri have arrested 31 people in continuing protests over the fatal police shooting of an unarmed teenager. Two people were injured and police came under heavy gunfire in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, which has seen a series of violent protests since the death of 18-year-old Michael Brown on August the 9th. Israel says militants have fired rockets from Gaza in violation of a truce and that it had struck back with attacks in the Palestinian enclave. The new fighting puts talks in Cairo on a long-term ceasefire in jeopardy. An Israeli official said Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ordered his negotiating team in Egypt to return home. The US Federal Aviation Administration has barred all American airlines from flying over Syria, saying the ongoing armed conflict and volatile security environment poses a serious potential threat to civil aircraft. 15 bodies have been retrieved from the scene of an attack on a convoy of refugees in eastern Ukraine. Earlier, a rebel source told correspondents no one had survived an attack on a convoy of refugees in the Luhansk area on Monday. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we head to Kenya, where Tristan McConnell joins us on the line now. Tristan, a warm welcome as ever. I imagine that Ebola is dominating the headlines.
Absolutely it is, yeah. I mean, this is becoming as big a story in my part of the world, in East Africa, as it is, you know, elsewhere in Europe, in America. Kenya Airways became the latest airline to suspend flights to West Africa, to both Liberia and Sierra Leone. Its last flights are today, and that's for an unspecified amount of time. British Airways and others have already suspended their flights, and so it's becoming more and more part of the conversation here in Kenya, the fear that, you know, a case might make its way to this part of the world. And really, you know, is Kenya prepared to deal with that threat? I mean, we've seen in the example of the two American doctors who both contracted Ebola and were taken back to the United States, and you know, there you have specialist equipment, people who are able to, you know, truly isolate and begin to try and treat victims of Ebola. But, you know, here in Kenya, there's a huge degree of skepticism over whether the government health services are really capable of dealing with the threat in an effective manner. So far, there have been no confirmed cases of Ebola here, but it's certainly something that people are very worried about, and, you know, increasingly worried as we look at what's happening in places like Liberia, especially, as well as Sierra Leone, where you've got entire communities being quarantined, and where, you know, the governments are really struggling to get this outbreak under control.
And to what degree are the Kenyan authorities giving any degree of reassurance that were Ebola to hit the country that you happen to be in, they would be able to contain it and keep everyone safe?
Yeah, they've been making, you know, statements saying, yes, we're prepared and so forth. But if you know, particularly if you look on social media or just have a chat with people down in the pub here in Nairobi, there isn't a great deal of faith in the government's pronouncements. And so far, I mean, the main kind of measures that have been taking is that, you know, people are having their sort of temperature checked when they arrive from West Africa on flights. But, you know, we all know, or at least we're all getting to know, that you don't become symptomatic from Ebola in up to 3 weeks. And so it's very easy for someone to arrive showing no symptoms and then begin going about their normal life wherever they live before they become symptomatic and therefore contagious. And the government has also said that it's set up isolation wards and so on. But there's a degree of skepticism here about whether Kenya is truly prepared for what many people think is kind of inevitable.
You mentioned that people have this sort of awareness of what is going on in West Africa. To what degree is it dominating day-to-day lives and conversations?
Well, you know, this is Kenya, and everyone talks about politics the whole time. So politics is still, you know, the dominant feature of the daily sort of discourse, whether that's in the media, in the newspapers, or just amongst people. But it's an increasing part of the conversation. It's getting in there alongside, you know, the routine conversations about crime and so forth. And it certainly seems to be rising up the agenda over the last week or so, and certainly with this announcement from Kenya Airways, which came over the weekend, that they would, after all, be suspending flights to both Liberia and Sierra Leone. I think that has really given Ebola a kind of a jolt up the conversation here.
Tristan, let's move on to South Sudan, where a division between two potential leaders of a political party has had a terrible effect on dividing the country.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And there's really no sign at all at the moment of any sort of serious progress towards peace. There just doesn't seem to be any real political will between the president and his former vice president to bring about a peace deal. And this is, you know, despite the huge scale of the humanitarian crisis that is engulfing South Sudan as a result of this conflict, which began in December, and also in spite of huge international pressure. It was only a few days ago that we had a delegation, very high-level delegation from the UN Security Council, which visited the capital Juba and met with the president, also met with the former vice president Riek Machar, who's in charge of the rebels, and then visited Ethiopia, which has been hosting these peace talks that have really gone nowhere over recent months. And it was only a couple of days after they'd left that, you know, fighting started up once again in the town of Bentiu, which is a strategic town in the middle of the main oil fields in South Sudan. So despite all of this pressure and all of the sort of the tragedy and horror on the ground in South Sudan, the political leaders are more interested in fighting than anything else at the moment.
To what degree are the political leaders paying any attention to the unfolding humanitarian disaster?
I mean, I would say, from my experience having been in South Sudan and reported on the ground in some of the places that have been affected by the conflict, and having followed very closely the peace talks such as they are up in Addis Ababa, I would say they've shown zero compassion for their own people in the situation that they find themselves in on the ground there. I mean, the UN has been warning for some months now that a famine is looming in South Sudan, and you know, all indicators are that we will see famine levels of malnutrition in some parts of South Sudan in the months ahead. And meanwhile, the impression is growing that the only reason we've seen a lull in the fighting in the last couple of months is that it's the rainy season. And when that ends, probably in October, perhaps early November, the fighting is likely to restart again. So there's really no sign that the political leaders are showing any care whatsoever for the plight of the people that they are supposed to be leading.
Let's move finally briefly on, Tristan, if you may, on to elephants. This is a desperately sad story. One would have assumed that the killing of elephants was something that we dealt with at the end of the last century. Not so.
Yeah, it's really getting out of hand. And this new report, which was published today, is particularly kind of frightening because it basically tells us that elephants are being killed off more quickly than they are giving birth. So the researchers looked back at the last few years, from 2010 to 2013, and found that on average about 35,000 elephants were being killed every year. So that's over 100,000 in just the last 3 years. But that on average per year, that was a 7% decline in the elephant population, and you know, usually they grow by about 5%. So we are seeing a steady decline. And the worrying thing here is that it's very clear that measures on the ground here in Africa to protect elephants, you know, through armed patrols and so forth, are not working. And really, they're never going to work. The only solution is to hit this where the demand is, and that is in China in particular and elsewhere in Asia, where ivory is still in some sects of society regarded as a sort of a product that is desired and a way of showing your wealth and success. And until people find a way to reduce the demand, the slaughter is not going to stop.
Tristan, as ever, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It's 1941 if you're just heading out for a schnitzel in Vienna. It is 1341 if you are in Boston. Here in London, it's 1841. Welcome back to Midori House. This is Emma Nelson. Time now to explore what big budget drama might have to say about Chinese culture. Heidi Wang from LSE joins me now to tell us about a 48-episode, good Lord, episode about a crucial part of China's history. Tell us a little bit more.
This is a big project lasting already for 4 years, actually. And the government has spent £11 million on this project. So this is about the Deng Xiaoping, the paramount leader who initiated opening and reform policy, and who is always tributed because of the economic reform, which actually changed China. And this year is the 110th anniversary of his birth. So that's why the Chinese government wanted to spend so much money and energy and also personnel to commemorate this great leader of China.
You say it's 48 episodes long, but House of Cards it is not, one person has said.
I doubt the quality of this TV program is as good as House of Cards. But still, I think the timing is very important because this is approaching the National Day. So this will be broadcast through September to October. So paving the momentum of praising the Communist Party and celebrating the National Day.
And making a lot of Chinese sit on their sofas for a couple of months.
Forced to, I think.
Let's have a little bit of a listen to this blockbuster.
1 月8日，中华人民共和国国务院总理周恩来逝世。拿着这张，爸爸年轻的时候，读着世界。
寄来的春天，花儿漫过。
48 episodes in 48 seconds. Heidi Wang, I've never seen someone scribble in Mandarin, especially not at that speed. Can you briefly tell the listeners what on earth was going on apart from an awful lot of rain? And so someone saying thank you, apparently.
Yeah, the backdrop of this TV series is 1976, when Zhou Enlai passed away, and when the history of Deng Xiaoping was moving forward, when he got the power. And the sentimental music, I think, is a transition from the turbulent time of Cultural Revolution towards Deng's period, which is marked by opening and reform policy. So this is a very nice transition to link Mao's period to Deng's period. So that's the background of this clip.
Neatly translated. Thank you very much indeed, Heidi. We mentioned, though, the idea of the Chinese people being glued to their sofas for the next couple of months. How is this going to change, or how has this changed, the way that Chinese people watch television or absorb their popular culture?
I think this is a very good question. I think for the young people, this TV program has invited many criticism from the youth, and the producer, the chief producer, welcomed the criticism.
Why?
Of course, the criticism.
What are they unhappy about?
The criticism is not critical. It's about why the music is always from the Hollywood. Why don't we have independent music? And also, there are many historical details which the producer has ignored. So it becomes more and more interactive between the producer and the young audience. So this is one change of the how Chinese people view television. The second change, or not really a change, is that people are still forced to watch something which is not as popular or as good as expected. Because Deng Xiaoping is a paramount leader, so there is a regulation in the Communist Party to commemorate national leaders in a very big scale. Last year, they have commemorated Mao Zedong, the founding father of the People's Republic of China, and this year they want to have the same or bigger scale to commemorate Deng Xiaoping. So the schools, governmental agencies are ordered to watch this TV program and also initiated discussions.
I mean, what you've just said there is something that perhaps doesn't surprise me a great deal, but it is very, very strange to think that a country is being forced to watch a television program. But also, to what degree does this 48 episode blockbuster consolidate the idea that the state controls the output of the country's culture?
I think for the first reason, the 48 TV program or episodes have consolidated the power of Xi Jinping, because he wants to initiate a further reform, which is a follow-up of Deng Xiaoping's opening and reform policy. Because of the very delicate image of Deng Xiaoping and how successful he was, this actually reassured the Chinese audience to follow the Chinese leader always, because they're always right. So they served the political agenda very nicely.
And finally, Heidi Wang, how many episodes of the 48 have you watched?
Only one episode, and I doubt how many I would like to watch further.
Do you think it ends well?
I hope so, because it's a big project, it spends a lot of money, so I hope the project goes well, ends well.
Here's hoping for a happy ending. Heidi Wang from LSE, thank you very much indeed, as ever. Now, in just a moment, Monocle's Robert Bound will join me to discuss this year's Green Man Festival in Wales had to offer. To get us there, let's listen to one of the festival highlights, described as adult rock. This is War on Drugs with Red Eyes. Red Eyes there by War on Drugs. It's 18:50 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson. Now, time for a little bit of a cultural review. Our culture editor, who else? Robert Bound, along with Holly Fisher and Paul Noble, pitched up their tents and enjoyed a glass or two of local ales at this year's Green Man Festival in Wales. A festival that started off with folk roots but has developed into much, much more. Robert came into the studio a little earlier to tell me all about it. Robert Bound, washed, clean, tidy, slept?
Absolutely. I have now, and I'm nice and throaty on my way back.
Fantastic.
I'm sure the cold's got nothing to do with spending three nights under canvas in Wales, and it's got everything to do with a dodgy sandwich.
It started off folky, but it's moved on an awful lot. So give me an example or a little bit of a taste of what you are enjoying.
Okay, well, we're going to play some tracks, and the first track I want to play is from The War on Drugs. I think they're four albums into their kind of adult-orientated rock kind of thing. They're a little bit Neil Young.
That sounds very late night.
Yeah, well, it's kind of not adult like that. Not like Top Shelf, like as in
top
kind
shelf
of Dire Straitsy, Neil Youngy kind of thing. They're part of the kind of Philly scene with Kurt Vile. And this is a track from an album called Lost in the Dream. This is Red Sky.
On Drugs there, with the name of a track that you're going to explain in a minute. It does sound as if it's something that you would listen to while in Welsh Wales in a mountain.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a good driving song as well. We had that on the car on the way down, and then hey presto, there he was 2 days later singing it on stage. He was amazing. It's The War on Drugs. It's a strange name for a band, but one which I wholeheartedly agree with, kids. Also, I got the name of that wrong. It's called Red Eyes, not Red Sky. So there you go.
It doesn't matter. It,
either way,
name?
It sounds like a song written for a sunset, so, you know, who's to blame? His bad, I'd have said. So that is The War on Drugs. They played the Mountain Stage, which is the main stage. It's called the Mountain Stage because it's the backdrop of a mountain, which is very beautiful. And that is a natural amphitheatre, which is a kind of great place to stay. I went up on stage and kind of looked down at the crowd, and it was kind of an amazing place to be. Yeah. At the necessary wristbands, it was fine. There was one great thing. I got to introduce some of the bands on one of the stages, which was really good. Started off pretty nerve-wracking, but ended up really fun.
That Mr. Noble really did rope you in, didn't he?
Yeah, I was roped in thoroughly.
You
a band called Fat White Family I got to introduce. Who were kind of like the new Oasis, and they're pretty leery. So were their fans. So it was kind of nice to introduce them.
How
a lot
pleasant.
Of barracking down the front. You know.
Brilliant fun. What,
should we go somewhere else?
Yes, please.
Let's go to Necco Case.
Okay.
She was born in Virginia, but she's kind of part of a Canadian kind of country rock scene. This is from an album called Fox Confessor Brings the Flood. This is called Hold On, Hold On. Compared to some I've been around, but I really tried so hard. Let it go, course, let me wait. Hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on. In the end, I was the mean girl.
Just listening to that and listening to the first track from War on Drugs, I'm spotting a little bit of a guitar-y.
Yeah.
Almost folky pattern. It's not this festival hasn't said goodbye completely to its folk roots.
No, it hasn't. No, I mean there's kind of as the night kind of goes on and on different stages it gets a little bit more electro-y and it gets a bit more dancey to kind of I guess, you know, kind of tick the boxes that kind of festival goers kind of want to go to later in the night. But yeah, it's definitely got kind of a guitar-y kind of bass to it. And then and in fact for preceding an Echo Case on that stage was a new artist called Angel Olsen who we've reviewed in the magazine who's got that kind of similar kind of country rock thing, kind of very literate, kind of a little bit Jenny Lewis-ish, kind of literate, arched eyebrow, strong women with kind of strong songs and wonderful voices. So she was fantastic. She was on the Mountain Stage as the sun came down. Lots of good between song bants as well. So thanks for that, Necco Case. And she's got a good look. She's got sort of flowing red hair and she's a fiery lady.
I find that almost more important than the music in many cases is the in-between bants.
Oh, the bants.
The look's fine.
Yeah.
But what is said, because you learn so much more about an artist about what they say than them just reading it out and saying, Wales, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Wales. One of the things that she said between her songs was that she'd heard that in the lost and found part of the festival, you know, the little tent where people chuck their stuff that's been lost, there was a unicorn finger puppet was found. And she said, I think that just sums up the festival perfectly. I don't know whether that was true or not, whether she says that at every festival. That was pretty good.
That
pretty good
be,
bants.
Must be where I left it this weekend. What's next, Mr. Bound?
We're going to go dancey now. Caribou played at about midnight on the Far Out stage, which is a big tent. Yeah, kind of far out on the site. And these guys from Ontario, or this guy, Dan, got party started. This is Sun from the album Swim.
That's a very different sound to what we've heard from the first two tracks. You mentioned the fact that he's quite folky. Then you said that the people that you introduced had sort of quite a louty feel to it. That's really quite late night and a whole different kind of entertainment crowd that one would imagine would be coming to this. Who's actually going to Green Man?
Well, there's kind of, I think it's a pretty broad church of people, if indeed they do go to church, which I'm sure they all do.
I would hope they did.
I think the kind of programmers, yeah, have got this kind of Catholic taste thing where you program quite guitar-y bands, folky bands, and then it kind of gets a bit rockier as the night goes on. And then, of course, most festivals have their dance tent.
Needs to go have a little bit of a bounce up and down.
Yeah,
in the
but it's more like electronic music rather than kind of rave. It's not a rave up, but there's more like, you know, I guess there's more composition. So you'd have maybe Hot Chip there would play, who are at least they're composers, they're musicians that do
dance
music. Rather than acid house or something kind of properly bananas. And the irony, it's called Sun, but he played it in the dark. Do you want another song? You want one last one?
One, please.
Martin Carr, you might know from the Boo Radleys.
Yes.
We went on Green Man Radio and I was speaking to Pete Fides, who's a friend of that radio station, friend of this radio station
indeed.
As well. And he played us a track and I was like, what's this? It sounds like the Boo Radleys. He goes, yes, this is a new record from Martin Carr. It's called Santa Fe Skyway and it's from a new album coming up in September, which I think we're going to review as well. I was drunk inside my socks, laughing as I rocked up to your house. Your father kicked me out, said I was a lout and a liar. Martin Carr and the Santa Fe Skyway, ending that chat with Robert Bound. You can hear that episode of Culture from the Green Man Festival all throughout this week, or go to iTunes, or go to our website, or go to SoundCloud. Just download it and enjoy. But that's all we have time for today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield and James Boyes. My thanks also to our producer Isabel Kayser, our researcher David Pleasant and Rowan Borcher, and our studio manager Sam MP. Next up, after the news, is Section D with Tom Morris. Then at 2200 hours, Monocle Daily will follow. But from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.